welcome to the latest episode of the Brush Builders Union podcast. I am your host and general president of the Brush Builders Union, Simon Berman. This month, I am joined by legendary game designer Tuomas Pyrinen. You may know his work most famously as the creator of Mordheim, but since then, he has worked on many other games, including the 6th edition of Warhammer Fantasy Battle and many video games, working at companies like Ubisoft, Electronic Arts, Climax, Slant 6 Games, and more. And most recently, Tuomas has come on to work on the team for the upcoming miniatures game Trench Crusade, which I am personally very excited about. But Tuomas, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. I've been following your career for many years. Your games have brought me much joy over the decades.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I think Mordheim is, you know, one of those games that I think it's eternal in miniatures wargaming, right? It's become such an iconic classic, and you know, the guys in my wargaming club, they have a Mordheim campaign going on this past winter. I think it's still ongoing, and you know, it's just a game that that you can't stop.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. It's the cause, obviously, at that point at Games Workshop, we did a lot of what we sort of called the hobby games or smaller games, and really didn't think too much about them. And then you have Mordheim that's not only survived 25 years, most of it without any support from any company, and it's not only survived, but it's quite likely more popular now than it's ever been, even when it was released. Like the if you look at the online activity and the groups, they easily, it's the match the most popular skirmish games in the world. And that's this, despite no new miniature releases, no terrain, it's the no rules. I mean, granted, I've been part of the community, but obviously not as a full-time designer. Just
sure.
Of how would I say? It's the bless my my fellow hobbyists.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a game that the community has been keeping alive in a way that I think is unusual, right? I think, you know, most unsupported miniatures games, they may have their little diehard group of players, but, you know, by and large, they go the way of the Dota. But Mordheim is, like you said, it's bigger and better than ever. I'm curious, do you have any idea why it might resonate with people so much?
I have a couple. And I don't think, like most things, it's the people like sound bites that you say one sentence and everybody goes, oh, that's it.
Sure.
Life is rarely like that. There's usually multiple reasons. I mean, one thing you can't discount is that it's the purest project art directed by John Blanche. Like the whole, John is my friend and obviously just retired from Games Workshop after the leading the artistic vision for 46 years.
I know, his incredible legacy for him.
Yeah. But only one game did he art direct from beginning till finish and the control, all the aspects, and it's Mordheim. So I think there is, like, if you just see the Mordheim artwork, it sticks with you for the rest of your life because it's actually is art, not just illustrations.
Yeah.
And that's purely down to John. I think also, like, the nowadays, like, fighting in ruined cities is a standard deal. It's the most skirmish games do it because, why wouldn't you? But at that point, nobody had done it. And I love buildings when I was at GW, and I thought these are awesome, except they are the worst thing ever for a miniature game because they have slanted roofs. You can't put models inside them, not really. The rules are a nightmare because you have to abstract. What if we just laid the waste on them, Misty? They will ruin them all. And it turned the games, which thus far had mainly been in miniature games, very, very horizontal, two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
It brought the verticality into the miniature gaming in a very, very different way. I mean, Necromunda had dabbled with that a bit, but the Mordheim went full hog because there were rules in the game to support
vertical
gameplay. I also think that the right from the beginning, it appealed to converters and the hobbyists more than people who just wanted to buy something off the shelf. And those are the people who tend to stay the longest.
Right, because they're invested, right?
They are. I mean, and they are that kind of people that they invest. They are people who get invested in things. So the core was already there. And then on top of it, it was instead of, as you might have noticed, most GW games at that point, they got their official support from the main studio, i.e. people like me and Jervis and Andy Chambers and Rick Priest and others. But the Mordheim was immediately after release and initial support turned over to the new fanatic that the Jervis was heading. So the community got into the habit of contributing and building the game right from the beginning. That was actually even before that, because I actively engaged the community during the actual development. So yeah. I think it's just a game that the maybe the community just sort of feels that they have the right to build on it themselves. And quite frankly, the amount of stuff, scenarios, warbands, let alone conversions, painting that the hobbyists have done, they will always outproduce anything that GW or any other games company can ever do times 1,000. So the content is there and it keeps coming and getting better and more plentiful.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that you brought the audience into the creation of the game to a certain extent very early on. That feels very forward thinking to me. You know, I think these days when a new game comes out, there's almost always an external playtest document that, you know, almost anybody involved with can pick up and participate in. But I feel like Mordheim may have kind of laid the groundwork for that. Do you think so? And how did you come to the conclusion that you should involve the community? Because I think that wasn't really done in the 90s, was it?
No. But at that point, it will sound insane, probably to most of your listeners, but at that point, communication was by paper mail.
Yeah.
So outside playtesting you couldn't do it. It would be too slow.
Yeah.
I came from Finland that was a front runner on internet. So I was already used to, because the Finland was very, very tech savvy, I was used to communicating people with online. So the whole idea that I could have people all around the world play things to me and reporting back, like play the game, write the message, and I would get it immediately, it was radical. I mean, it's the Brits, bless their souls, didn't know what to do with it. But I had in that culture for years. So for me, it was very easy to set it up, because I thought I need bloody, it can't be just me and Alessio and Gav playing it. It's because we don't have time to play all the games that you should play. So, and the design studio was very, very, very supportive and super enthusiastic. And I ran the first ever narrative Mordheim campaign there. But it was still only some dozens of games. And in reality, if you want to have a game that's any good, you need to play loads more games, or you have to be extremely good at your job. So it was just natural, but it was bizarre to the Games Workshop at that time. I had the closest point in my career I got to be fired was when I suggested at GW that they would sell their models on internet. Sales director is it was Ronnie Renton at that time, just took me aside and gave me the bollocking of my life that we will never sell anything through internet. Is we talk to people on phones, and look at Games Workshop now.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah, but I was given the clear mandate from the highest possible level on the company that they never ever will Games Workshop sell anything online.
Incredible. Oh, that's so cool. And it really set that playtest really must have set the tone for so much. Cause, you know, I got involved working at Privateer Press in 2008, which is only 9 years later, which, you know, it seems like a long time, but it really isn't. And, you know, by that time, the internet organization of playtesting was so big. You know, we were still doing internal stuff then, but, you know, by 2012, we were doing getting into like Mark III and stuff. There were, well, 2014, 15, but there was such a, it was almost taken for granted that you would do a public playtest now. And I think it's wild to think that, you know, Mordheim kind of was foundational in that way that we make miniatures games.
Yep. But I was dealing mainly with paper mail, like the obviously there was a tons and tons and tons of fan mail from the coming in from all the Warhammer and 40K fans. It was all letters.
Yeah.
There wasn't really an email to send them, and when they came, nobody knew what to do with them, and
Right. They
weren't really respected because it was thought that nobody puts any thought or effort into them, so they are just trash. So, but I came from a different background and a different culture and sort of a understanding of what the internet could be. So, obviously, it would have come to Games Workshop eventually anyway. I'm not that
jaded
to think that I would have changed it alone. But yeah, I was a pioneer. So
that's happy about that.
But I think you can trace the roots of Mordheim's current success to those halcyon days. It's the, that it was set out to be a community game.
That's fascinating. You know, and I think it, you see that in every aspect now, you know, with the blossoming of 3D printing. So many people are printing not just the miniatures, you know, they're designing their own miniatures or designing miniatures they like and then selling the STLs, the files to download and print them yourself. But even the terrain, you know, the guys in my club, they have this incredible multi-tiered ruined Mordheim city board, or actually several boards worth that, you know, it's almost all 3D printed. And I think it's cool the community can even get involved, not just in the rules, which are sort of abstract, but in the actual physicality of the game. Did you ever think you'd see something like that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think in some ways, the Mordheim's blossoming has really been happening because of that revolution on the physical printing, because you looked at the you remember probably the original Mordheim board from the rulebook, which was absolutely revolutionary at the time. It was modular. It was very multidimensional. Like it was incredible also to play with it, because every single piece of it could be moved, and it looked brilliant and didn't look at all modular when you set it up. But that's also, I think, been one of the secrets to the Mordheim's longevity, that you look at you go to any convention, the Mordheim table is the one that draws your eye, because everything else is basically usually just a flat plane with right. some bits sticking out, and then you have these crazy ruined buildings in impossible angles and the soaring towers and the, like, it's really like these centerpieces for each of the boards. It really makes you go and look at, what is this? This looks fascinating. And I think it is a very good self-recruiting game, and it draws in just the right kind of people to keep the game going.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think one of the interesting things I recognized when I was at Adepticon last month was looking at the various tables. Like you said, you know, the Mordheim tables, they're very identifiable because they are so vertical. And I realized that in a lot of ways, you know, when they design miniatures, they talk about the silhouette of the miniature, making sure that the silhouette is recognizable from a distance, right? Mm. And I feel like Mordheim boards have a silhouette all of their own, right? They're going to be 2, maybe even 4 feet tall with these weird towers and stuff, and it's immediately captivating and very iconic.
Yep.
In a way that I don't see a lot of other miniatures games tables look like.
No, I call, in Mordheim, I'll call the table a third player. I think it's just as important as the people and the warbands they brought to the table is as important. And I think you brought a good point about the skyline, because if somebody asks you, tell me something about Paris, you're just going to say Eiffel Tower.
Sure.
New York, it's you're going to call the Statue of Liberty or the famous skyline. In almost the Paris, it's the Arc of Triumph. It's the any city, London, Big Ben. It makes the skyline is more important than people realize also to miniature gaming, which makes sense that it's important in miniature games, because we are humans that are playing the game. So we pay attention to the things we pay attention to. The fact that we love the skylines of the cities, it isn't that somebody forced us to do it. It is inherent to us that we enjoy it.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. So when you were designing Mordheim originally, What were your kind of goals with the game in the broadest strokes? Like, you know, obviously you had John Blanche's incredible art to draw upon, but, you know, what was the experience you wanted to give people?
Oh, my goals, the first one was very clear, because it came from the company. We wanted a gateway game to Warhammer Fantasy Battles. It was then, and remained so, extremely expensive game to get into, and extremely complex, and the requiring a high level of skill and experience. 40K was and is much more accessible. They wanted a game that the people could get an easy in into the Warhammer Fantasy world and then become a Warhammer Fantasy Battle hobbyists. So that was the overarching goal. Later on, this was regretted, because it's actually, I really took it in my heart to try to make it as cheap as possible to get to play Mordheim. So eventually the powers that be probably wanted it to, not probably, they wanted it to make a lot more money per player than it did. To me, there was the couple of things I wanted to get out. I wanted the low fantasy, like this grimy, it's the desperate, dangerous game. I wanted the sense of exploration and the finding new things as you explore the city. And I wanted this contrast, because the Warhammer Fantasy Battle was all about magnificent uniforms and titanic monsters and devastating spells. And I wanted sort of the feeling of the old school low fantasy, like the desperate knife fights in an alley and the weird mutated creatures and the depths of human depravity and the sort of these interesting things that once you get into the no man's land where there is no law, then the people turn into the monsters and they are much worse than the monsters that are.
Sure.
Gameplay wise, I just wanted there was a lot of things I liked about the skirmish games at GW at that time, and a lot of things that I hated, like hated is the wrong word. Rules that I think were too clunky or too powerful or too unbalancing or especially slowed the game down. So you see a lot of the rules of Mordheim, like the shooting the closest target, when you are down or stunned, that it happens with the physical, getting the models to turn them over. There was no dice rolls to slow it down. I had the henchmen didn't have the same complexity as the heroes, which it took a long time to update your gang on Necromunda at that point. There was a lot of stuff where I went, gaining the experience, you didn't have to roll, you tick these boxes. And these were a lot of these things that I wanted the game to just flow better. Yeah. Like I was very, very proud of how I got the income and exploration into a single dice roll that you could modify then with the various things, like with the Elven Scout, that the meant a lot, that then led into a lot of things. But instead of you just having to spend hours to roll dice again and again and again, like in Warhammer Quest, you got so much out of a single handful of dice.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was almost elegant, right? You know, being able to like refine that post game bookkeeping down to just a handful of random choices. Mm. So with Mordheim, from there, I believe you went on to work on Warhammer Fantasy Battle 6th Edition. Is that correct?
Yeah, and before that, of course, Realm of Chaos. That's
Me
and John Blanche started our cooperation. I mean, of course, I worked on a lot of army books. It's the Vampire Counts. It's a lot of the campaign boxes, the Dogs of War, High Elves. You name it, I worked on it. But sort of cooperation where John Blanche actually decided that he wanted to work with Cosplay. John doesn't have to do what he didn't want to. He was the big art chief.
Sure.
But our cooperation on Realm of Chaos was so fruitful and we really clicked. Then he wanted to do Mordheim with me. So it's very important you look at my career in GW. It's probably the most important things. It's Realm of Chaos, Mordheim, and Warhammer 6th Edition. For I am very, very, I really love working on the Warhammer Siege as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Warhammer Siege as part of sort of the 6th Edition, but let's talk about Warhammer Siege. You know, what do you love so much about that?
The feeling that the instead of just using the hit points and toughness and whatnot, that the feeling that you are reducing the walls little by little, and then that you play, because the sieges were not just that the army turned up and started besieging. There was a lot of positional battles and slowing down the approach. So there was the campaign that led to the siege. But I really liked the being able to explore the siege equipment, siege towers, ladders, halfling oxtail soup, whatnot. And to come up with a system where a very, 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 very lucky shot of a cannon might bring down the wall quite quickly, or they might be a very, very long running back and forth. So I really enjoyed that. I love the original Warhammer Siege, but it was unplayable. Like as the people who worked on it told me that we never finished the game. It was too complex. So we're trying to reduce it in something that you actually can play.
Right.
Yeah, but all my best games at the studio were Siege Battles. It's and I understand it never became as big as main game, obviously, because it's a lot of money and a lot of work to do.
Sure.
But I think some supplements are aspirational.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. I think back to all the various wargaming books I've read over the years. One of my favorites, one of the things that got me into War Machine, which led to my career at Privateer Press eventually, was their Escalation campaign, which is basically an impossible book to play, but you read through it and it's so inspiring. It makes you want to just play whatever games you can. And I think that's a really great point you've brought up, that Assaultman can be aspirational.
Yep. I mean, but look at original 40K. It is the most, arguably, and most likely also, is the most important book ever published in wargaming history. But it was not very playable. I mean, Rick would be the first person to say that. Sure. Absolutely groundbreaking, revolutionary, and the successful beyond the wildest imaginations of GW. And shows that despite all his many faults, because Brian Ansel didn't believe in 40K, but he said, I might be wrong, so let's go.
Yeah, I mean, that original 40K book is brilliant, but it's more of like a toolbox for running your own little RPG-ish skirmish war games, right, than it was like a proper rulebook as we think of them today.
Yeah. But sometimes it's the strength of idea trumps the execution, and in that case, like, well, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, the importance of the rogue trader is it just can't be overstated.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, it's something I've been thinking a lot about in terms of game design lately, and that's that, you know, I think there's been a real movement to when you're critiquing a game and thinking about what makes a game work, to really just look at the mechanics. And I think one of the I think it's almost missing the point, because at the end of the day, it's about how the game makes you feel, right? And if the rules are successful, they're making you feel good about the game you're playing. They make you want to think about it. Mm.
Yep, make you feel good or make you feel right. Like if you're making a horror game, you should feel that it's desperate and difficult and you are in a constant mortal danger. But a really good horror game, of course, doesn't let you die on the first turn. It tortures you. It's you're waiting like Zombicide. I love the zombie horde system. I mean,
sure.
It's perfectly balanced. Who cares? It's right? Super exciting. It's the what is coming next and the being terrified if it's something really dangerous. So I think the player experience is the how it makes you feel. It's the always, there are lots of extraordinarily well designed, especially German board games. I love their game design. They are so good at it. But compared to their output and quality, the real breakthrough hits are Betrayer, because they tend to pick up subjects and the game mechanics are so brilliant that the element of surprise and sort of the organic storytelling is kind of missing in a lot of them. Not the best ones of them, like the best German board games are the best in the world, but I think the games that might have a sometimes clunky rules are good for that reason. So let's say if you have an orc with a cannon, it's much cooler to roll the dice that because the gun is really janky. So you roll D6, how many times it shoots, and if you roll one, it gets stuck. And then but 2, 4, 5, or 6 is you get 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 shots out of it, and then you roll it. I can turn the probability and the damage of that into a single roll. But the point is that it's an orc's gun, so it's fun to see that how many barrels actually manage to shoot, or does it get stuck. So that rule for that situation is much worse in a game mechanics point of view. It's clunky, it's slow, but it's much more fun to think you're an orc and you have this awfully wonky cannon with a bent barrels and to see how
it works. No, that's a really great point. So what I was kind of curious was, you know, you talked about how Mordheim was meant to be, well, as far as the company was concerned, it was created to be a feeder game to get people playing Warhammer Fantasy Battle. And then you went on and worked on an edition of Warhammer Fantasy Battle. I was curious, did your experience with Mordheim inform that edition of Fantasy Battle?
Absolutely. So it gave me courage, because the Warhammer 4th and 5th edition, where they were called Hero Hammer, it was all about really powerful individual heroes and big monsters just wiping out the enemy formations, and you put all your points in them, and very few on you spend as little on your troops as possible, and the I didn't want, that wasn't my vision of the Warhammer world. I had been a long-running Warhammer Fantasy role-play game master in Finland. And the I love the grim world of Perilous Adventure, as did John Blanche, as did Rick Priestley. So mm-hmm. we did a step back and went a bit more gritty. I mean, the 6th edition artwork, the lore we wrote, it's the how we painted the models, all took a step more towards the what we established in Mordheim and Realm of Chaos than the really colorful and the sort of a whimsical cartoony style that the 4th and especially 5th had.
Sure. No, that makes perfect sense.
And my biggest game design changes were, of course, how you build armies and the power of magic items. Not so much the core system, because my brief started that the Warhammer is a classic game, so we are not looking to redesign it from the ground up.
Sure, you're fine tuning, right? Not starting over from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, Warhammer was a huge part of Games Workshop business as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think 6th edition is sort of widely considered to be one of the highlights of the game. Mm. So, that's very cool. So what I kind of was hoping to kind of lead into with all this stuff is, you know, let's talk about it. So after 6th edition, not too long after that, you went off and you started working in video games for a while. How was that?
Well, I mean, that's a very long career. We are talking
sure, about. Yeah, decades.
Yeah, we are talking about 2 decades and more on the I've worked on everything is the PC, console. I worked on the sort of a subscription games. I worked on the lots of premium games. I worked on all the consoles, including handhelds. I worked on a huge studios, the more biggest companies. Right now, I am at Sony's PlayStation for my day job, and to the tiniest indie shops. I work on absolutely everything: racing, shooting, third person adventure, role playing, strategy. Everything.
What was it like, you know, moving from as physical as a game can get into that video game space?
It isn't as different as you might think. Like you look at, for example, my Andy Chambers, who obviously had an extremely important career at Games Workshop as well. He was also the creative director of the StarCraft II,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, insanely huge game.
Sure.
It's really how I'd best describe it is that the video games are just turn-based board games where the turns come very quickly. All the same rules apply and the designer needs to do all the similar things. And if anything, in video games, it's even more important to think about how the player will feel, because you are responsible for all the audiovisual and tactile input for
right.
the controller.
That's very cool. Were there any standout games looking back in your immediate post workshop period that you still love and like?
I worked on the Black Box on the Need for Speed series. I know it sounds fun, but I've always liked racing.
Yeah.
So being able to work on that at that point, which was by far the biggest racing game franchise in the world, and the getting tens of millions of fans, it's the really
sure.
exciting, and they're doing this crazy street racing with the very much the Fast and Furious genre.
Yeah,
I absolutely enjoyed it because you had a cars of avatars of superheroes. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what the classic Need for Speed, like when I worked on the Underground 2, Most Wanted, Carbon, the Run era as the lead designer. It's I enjoyed it because it was actually very, very similar to what I've been doing before. Much more so than shooters, which most people might think is closer to 40K. But actually, shooters are very different. It's when you are controlling the guy shooting as opposed to the planning the strategy, tactical movements of the troops.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Very cool. So have you... As you've been working on video games and still are, do you still play a lot of miniatures games or do you still design any games in that period?
Yeah. I mean, I worked a little bit under pseudonym because of that. I had a contract, but I really
sure.
wanted to do some tabletop design. I've always played, especially board games, like all the time, nonstop. I've never stopped. Miniature games there is obviously all the Mordheim community. It's kept contacting me, and I kept in touch with them. And I picked up a, I tried when there was a new interesting, the miniature games, like the Star Wars, ship-to-ship combat. What was it called? God damn it, I can't remember. It's the, it's X-Wing? On my, shelf. Sorry?
Sorry, is this a miniatures game?
Yes.
Yeah, X-Wing maybe?
Yes, X-Wing, yeah. Massive game, like it's yeah. so much that is unbelievable. But and I always wanted to do more tabletop games, but I was so despondent never to be able to make a living out of it in a way that I could have provide a home for my family that I didn't really consider it. And that's why in many ways the my new project has been so satisfying since I've been able to do it without the losing my bread and butter.
Right. Yeah, so actually, let's get into that, because, you know, one of the things made me think of you recently as a guest for the podcast was Trench Crusade, and, you know, I had backed Trench Crusade's Kickstarter a couple of years ago when it was just a Kickstarter for some cool miniatures, you know, and they've got this very, you know, a little bit of a 40K aesthetic, but it's very much its own thing. It's sort of World War II, and the Crusades have never ended, so they've been going on for 800 years, and it's, the miniatures are just cool. And then it did so well, they announced that they're making their own game, and they had brought famous game designer Thomas Perrinen in to design the game. And I was like, I am super excited now. This is the best choice I've made in years. So I'd love to hear how you got involved with that game.
Yep. So I did a small little project with James, who is one of the of us three that are behind the Trench Crusade. It's the on the Mordheim Facebook group, if I recall correctly. So we've already had a little bit of a working relations, but on a very, very small fan project. But I mean, to me, my enthusiasm for project is not limited to its size. If it's going to be for, like, I run role-playing games, D&D or others, every week to my friends. And to me, they are at least as important as my professional work. And if I can get this tiny handful of my friends to really immersed in this the world and the story and the gameplay I've created is the that is just as important to me than to make a game that sells millions of copies for Sony PlayStation. So I was not adversarial at all. And then I got to talking to James I knew, then I talked to Mike Franchina, who is the artist behind the visual look of the project, and we just clicked. He obviously, his whole career is a one long homage to John Blanche.
Sure.
And we just hit it off creatively. It reminded me, like, working with John, where we are just both so excited about the creative possibilities, and we are on the same wavelength. So what we are bringing into the world, we both think, yeah, absolutely, that's the right thing, which makes the collaboration super easy, because you are just super excited to see
yeah.
And is doing
always
yeah. So the I decided to take it on as a fun little project I can that I can do as a side to my daily job, because I wanted to do some more tabletop design.
Yeah.
And I did have an embryonic idea. It's the that eventually became the current Trench Crusade rules, that I believe I had something to give to the tabletop gaming community still, that I could bring something fresh, new, unique, and hopefully in the same way that the Mordheim was able to take the skirmishing games forward through some of the design decisions I made, that I could maybe do the same with Trench Crusade, even if it wouldn't be that many people who played. But I have to say, I am absolutely stunned by the grassroots support and the growth we are seeing.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. The miniatures were beautiful from the start. The art seems super super evocative, and you know, you've got a playtest document out in there now too, don't you?
Oh yes, it's the I believe we are approaching something like just on the one place where it's the our central place. It's there's been tens of thousands of people, 10,000 people. Well beyond that now. It's the have gotten into it, and there is plenty more who've gotten it in various other ways. It's all these communities have popped up all over the internet, and the Like, we are growing by 1,000 people just on the Facebook group alone every week. It's,
wow.
It's absolutely astounding. Remember, there is no money changing hands here. It's purely happening on the grassroots level.
The ministries aren't even out yet.
No. Yeah. People have been bashing like absolute fiends, demons.
Yeah.
We just held a competition on the Facebook page of the Trench Crusade. Sorry, the group. We have the page for the game, but there is group for the fans.
And if I can interrupt, if you're listening to this podcast, all that stuff will be linked in the show notes. So if you're looking to get involved in any of that stuff, please go check the show notes and join yourself. But please go on.
Yeah. So the quality I'm seeing, the people's kit bashing, the conversions is as good as I've ever seen anywhere. There is like real non-astroturfed groundswell of excitement and support, and it's growing every day. Well, for a game that I didn't expect, if I'd get a couple of thousand people to play, then they tell me that, oh, I really enjoyed it, and they sparked my imagination. I thought, well, I'm super happy. But it certainly is shaping up to be something much bigger, which I am both astounded and delighted at.
Very cool. So let's talk a little bit about what the game is going to play like. You had mentioned that you had some hopes you were going to do some things that are going to be kind of new in miniatures board gaming. So what is the experience you hope a player gets out of Trench Crusade?
So I am hoping that you get all the depth of the best of the skirmish games. That takes all the conditions into account out of a much shorter game period, and that I maximize the player agency, like the classic you go, I go, you go. It's it's an old school design, and the we see skirmish games now much more with alternating order. But I'm going to step further with that with the system called the blood markers. So should I open up a little bit of the core game design?
Yeah, that'd be great. Actually, why don't we start? Can you give me like what is Trench Crusade about at the top level before we get too deep into the mechanics?
Yes. So Trench Crusade is a story of alternate history. During the First Crusade, some of the Crusaders committed the ultimate heresy. We don't know exactly what it is. There are whispers that they did something with the Holy Cross or the Crown of Thorns or the Body of the Redeemer. Nobody knows. But the end result was that the gate to hell was open in Jerusalem. The city was destroyed in a cataclysmic devastation. And the corrupted Templars who did the deed became the core of the mortal armies of the infernal realm. And the Great War, the real Great War started, and it has not stopped. So now it is the year 1914, and after 800 years of the stop-and-go warfare, endless offensives and the counter-offensives, and then periods of the very, very watchful and the violent periods of ceasefire, both sides are gearing up again for another massive battle where the heretics have been pushing the faithful nations ever further. They are now threatening North Africa, the Balkans. They have taken Gibraltar. Their submarine fleets prowl the seas and destroy the merchant fleets of the Europa and the Asia and Africa. And now it's the during this lull, is that both sides are sending their elite troops into the no man's land to gather information. It's the secure positions, find ancient relics, because the game is very much one where the divine and infernal powers take active part in the battles. And you take a command of one of these squads. You can be, for example, a follower of the infernal powers and their elite army unit, the Heretic Legion, or perhaps one of their variants like the Heretic Naval Landing Forces. Or you can serve one of the faithful nations. They are mainly concentrated in the city of New Antioch that acts as a sort of the first line of defense that protects the mainland Europe and the steppes of Asia. So all the faithful nations feed their armies to the main theater of war. So you can fight as a elite unit sent by the Duke of New Antioch out, or you could play the troops of the Sultanate of the Great Iron Wall that pierces the, of two horns, which that pierces the sky, which is the according to a prophecy in Quran. It's the during the, when the Gog and Magog, the people of the hell, is to rampage on Earth. A great iron wall will appear and to shelter it's the them. So this is what has happened. They've all concentrated in this massive the Giga Nation is the behind the iron wall and are fighting the heretics. But they are also rather miffed with the crusaders and
sure. they,
yeah, for opening the gate to hell. Or you could play the troops of Beelzebub, a lot of flies who just wants to turn the whole world into a diseased mush with the flies overseeing everything. And the you play one of these small elite squads and your mission is to the gather information, gather relics. It's the secure positions, spy on the enemy. And the this is the basis for the skirmish game.
Very cool. So it's sort of crusaders with machine guns fighting demons in the trenches of an endless World War One.
That's absolutely correct.
Awesome. Yeah, I love it. I can't wait to play it. I can't wait to get my miniatures. But now that we've got the theme kind of set, so yeah, let's talk about the mechanics you got in mind.
Yeah, so everything works on a one system. You take two six-sided dice, you roll them, and you try to score seven. If you scroll less, it's the you don't succeed. If you scroll seven or more, you succeed. Simple okay. stuff. Now, let's say it's the you are an elite heretic legionnaire who is quite good with your bolt action rifle. So your stat line states that you have plus one die on ranged. So in that case, you pick three six-sided dice. You roll them when you are shooting and you pick two highest, making it much more likely for you to hit a seven. And the you can have pluses and minuses depending on the how powerful it's the or how well trained, or maybe you have some supernatural help on these actions. It's the basic actions are ranged, melee, it's the dashing, which is the I'll come to the movement in a moment. But the then you can have various other actions, like if you're a battlefield medic and you have a first aid kit, you can take a first aid action. And again, same rules apply, and you might have bomb. Now, as you attack the enemies, it's the you again roll 2d6. It's you can either score a flesh wound, which just adds one blood marker. We'll come back to them in a later. You might score a down, so either you hit the enemy so that they go down, or maybe they throw themselves in the ground and you accumulate blood markers. Or you take them out, you shoot them in the head, they are gone. this is by 9+. Now, you can have various kinds of armor, and the armor in the Trench Crusade world, because of the supernatural metallurgy, is much more effective than in ours. So if you have a trench shield, when you're rolling that roll to injure somebody, it's the you deduct one. So instead of then needing 9 to take somebody out, you need 10. If you have an armor and a trench shield, it's the instead of 9, you need 10. And if you have a heavy armor and a trench shield or machine armor, which is like the ultimate armor, you deduct 3, which means that only a 12 on 2d6 will ever take out weapon that well armored. So your attack, which takes in most games, you need to roll 4 times to determine when something happens to the opponent. So you try to hit them, you try to wound them somehow or injure them, you roll how bad the injury is, you take an armor saving throw, everything comes out of 2 rolls in total. Now, you remember I mentioned the blood markers that you accumulate when you get hit. Now, every time I activate a model, if you're playing against me and my model has any blood markers, every time I take an action, you can decide to spend one or more of those blood markers taken out of the game and incur per blood marker one penalty die to my roll. So then, let's say we return to our example and my heretic trooper is shooting at your yeoman. And He has plus one die, so I'd be rolling 3d6 and picking two highest to get seven. Ooh, that's very likely I'm going to hit you, right? But I have two blood markers, and you really want to save that yeoman from a shot. You apply both of those blood markers, which then gives my shot. It's the two penalty dice. So the bonus dice that the heretic trooper has is cancelled, and then you get to apply one penalty dice. So again, I roll 3d6, but this time I pick the two lowest. Not the two highest.
Oh, interesting. And
the more penalty markers you, the more blood markers you the pile in, the more dice I have to roll, but I always pick the two lowest. So the blood markers can also be used. It's the for any other kind of action that that model takes. Or when you attack my heretic trooper, you might think that, no, I'm going to save those blood markers, because if I hit the heretic trooper, I can use those blood markers to enhance that injury roll. The same rule apply. If I put two blood markers down, instead of taking 2d6 and rolling them to see what the damage is, I pick the 4d6, because I apply two blood markers, and I pick the two highest. So you get much more likely to cause serious injury. So the both players are usually very much active participants, no matter who has activated the model. So there is almost no waiting, because you're always thinking that.
Your resources are all sort of shared between you and your opponent.
This is exactly correct.
Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, that's really cool.
And then the other thing that the I really change is that most games either have a really difficult to remember and bookkeeping heavy action point system, or there is a strict order which you take actions. And I ask the simple question, why? Uh-huh. Now, there is a reason that's mainly to do with movement, but I thought that that's bollocks. I don't want to do it that way, because it's really clunky and the games just reassemble each other. So in Trench Crusade, you decide every time in which order you take any and all of the actions that your model is able to take. You are not tied by any phase order. It's the you want to... So you have two kinds of movement. Three kinds. Is that you can dash, which is a risky action. So it means that if you fail, the activation ends. So you really want to wait. Do you want to do that? Unless your character is super good at dashing.
Sure.
You can move normally. You can charge, which involves a risk that you add d6 to your movement to see how far your charge will take you. If you have weapons, each one of them, you can take one action with each. You might have all sorts of other actions. It's if you're a healer, like I mentioned, you can move next to another model and try to remove with your first aid kit with an action, a blood marker, and so on and so forth. This gives an ability that if I'm willing to take a lot of risks, I can start by the enemy is far away, and it's taken your model has taken a cover under the behind the building's corner.
Sure.
I go, damn, I can't see it. I know you're there, but I can't move to attack you. But I'm going to dash. I'm going to climb, because you're on top of a building, and so I'm taking two the risky actions. But if I'm lucky, first of all, I get to do my normal movement as a dash. It's the before any other movement. I can get if I make the climbing the risky action, I get on top of the building. Now I see you, so I'm going to do a charge, and I'm higher than you, so it's another risky action. I'll do a diving charge, but if I do that, I get plus one bonus on both my attack and my injury rolls. So if you're willing to take the risk, or if it's the battle is hanging on balance, I can completely change the order of actions I take in order to bring about a very different turn than if I just do basic move and shoot. I might also have an assault weapon, which would allow me to move, the shoot, then charge, because the only assault weapons allow you to both the shoot and charge at the same time. Or if you're far away, I could dash first to try to cut the distance half so it's easier to hit, then shoot, then charge, and then fight you in close combat. So you see that this leads to a much more dynamic situation, very much based on how much risk you're willing to take as a player.
Oh, that's cool. I love the idea of the risky actions potentially leading to the end of your activation. Yeah. It reminds me of one of my favorite games ever is Blood Bowl, which is punishing on that. But if you push your luck too much, your turn is over and your opponent goes. And I think it's really cool to see that in a skirmish game.
Yep. The biggest thing I think why the people have made it clunky is that they haven't figured out how to they have to give like the double movement a higher cost in order for the balance out. I just put it into a risky action. So you can do an extremely heroic activation with single model if you're lucky.
Right. And if you're not, it's your opponent gets to go and your plans are in tatters.
Absolutely. You've got
it. Very cool. So I'm curious to talk about the way the game plays itself, not just the mechanics, but what size is the table and how do you envision the terrain? Because, you know, having worked on Mordheim before and talking about, you know, the importance of verticality, I can't imagine this is a very vertical game because it takes place predominantly in trenches. But what do you see the play experience at the table? Is it scenario driven? Is it a campaign? How do you see it actually playing?
Yeah, so I've written the scenarios. I've done something a bit more unusual. That the I've divided the campaigns into four phases: the early, middle, end, and then there is the final battle, which is then determined how the campaign goes. So the you have a smaller battles with smaller number of models, with a smaller stakes in the beginning, and the stakes ramp up as the game progresses. On a battlefield, there is a smaller model of the number of terrain. It's six bigger pieces and six smaller pieces, like a little cover, like sandbags or whatnot, is what I recommend. Table size, the important thing is that the troops need to start 24 inches between them. So the 3x3 or 4x4 table is really good. People seem to like 4x4, simply it gives them a little bit more defensive depth if you want to play a bit more conservatively. It's but if you only have your kitchen table, you can throw, you need a relatively small number of terrain. You throw them in, as long as there is 24 inches between you and your opponent's deployment zones, you're good to go.
Cool.
Which a lot of people seem to appreciate nowadays.
Yeah. No, that's great. I think having a compact game size, especially for a skirmish game, is really pretty important these days. So I think fewer people have houses to have large gaming tables on, unfortunately. But that's very cool. What are the scenarios like, though? What are the stakes that you're fighting over?
Well, obviously, there's quite a few, but there are the relic hunts. It's the where you are both ransacking the same monastery or a chapel or a basilica. There is take down the leaders. So we are trying to assassinate the opposing elites, and they are trying to assassinate yours. Now the trick is that the neither you nor your opponent know who the target is. So the you have to figure out who you should protect and allow to take risks. But of course, your opponent will be reading you. There is a lot of the because I like them that the there are objectives and the you gain victory points every turn, which allows the players to see that okay, I'm starting to lose, I need to start taking risks if I'm gonna pull this around. While the other player probably goes that right, I'm winning, I'd better not take so many risks, so which tends to lead much more interesting battles. Because then, if the other side takes great risks, it's the and succeeds, that's going to be a story to tell. There is also a system of called the glorious deeds. There are two currencies in the game. There are the gold ducats, which you use to buy everything, almost everything, and then there is a super special equipment and the weapons and the stuff like dogs, the medals, it's the peerage that give you various gameplay bonuses, which you can only gain with glory points. And the only way to get glory points is to do glorious deeds on a battlefield. So every scenario has a list of glorious deeds, and if you pull them off, you get a glory point. Now, these might be highly risky and highly dangerous and difficult to pull off, but then the only way to get that glorious piece of equipment you want is to take a glorious action. So but that's a player choice. Do they go for them? They do not like determine victory or defeat. I also have like the going through the over the top. It's the one side attacking through a minefield into the trenches, while the other side is the much smaller in numbers, but these defending. I tried to create some of these very classic World War One like archetypical battle scenarios. It's the chemical warfare. Is the fighting in the mustard cast. So I tried to create the sort of a mixture between grimdark horror and the World War One from the point of view of a poor Tommy that's being given a bolt action rifle to fight against these monsters from hell and the
right.
And good luck, Tommy. We are behind you. We stay behind you.
Awesome. So it seems like there's a campaign system for it as well. You know, how does your warband grow over time?
Okay. So one of the big problems a lot of skirmish games have is the fact that once you start losing, well, you're losing. Right. So I changed the system that you can always, after a battle, there is certain certain price you have to pay in the sort of freedom or in your after campaign sequence if you do that. But then you can replenish your force up to the current campaign threshold. So every time you fight in the campaign, the maximum size, the threshold of your warband grows. And if you decide to call in reinforcements, you get to replenish your warband up to the maximum allowed threshold, which if you've been absolutely wiped out in a previous battle and your campaign would be over, well, it isn't. You just have to decide right now. It's the right time to call the Duke of Andiok and say, "Sire, I lost my entire squad. Could you send some more Tommies?" it allows you to stay competitive to the very end of the campaign. A bit like in Mordheim, the elites gain experience. So basically, you gain experience from surviving. 1 point, everybody, and for every glorious deed that the model made. They will gain another experience points. If they gain 2 experience points in a battle, they get an advancement. Okay. Now, the system advancements is divided into several tables. And the thing is, you get to pick which 2 of the tables you roll and then choose from those results which one do you want. So you can you are not purely depending on luck. That's the... which allows you to sort of a bit more agency on your progress, while the other way that you could freely choose has easily leads into a situation where the players just always, everybody picks the same things, which leads into a boring, samey experiences.
Yeah.
And you can put up your standard troops for a promotion. So for like winning the battle, it's and the certain other conditions that depend on a scenario, you get promotion dice. You decide it's who gets the promotion dice, and you can double up and give a maximum 2 of any of your non-elites. And then you start rolling. If somebody rolls a 6, that model is promoted, and you can invent some corporal, sergeant major, whatever you want to call them. They become an elite. And then that's over. It's the only 1 promotion per battle. But then they become elites, and then they become eligible for progression.
Very cool. So how many games do you see being played in the campaign?
12 battles. That's what I've primed for. Now, the way I've written it, you want to do a full year campaign with the 1 battle per week and play 52 games. It'll work. But sort of my own experience was that usually by the 12th game is simply the advancements have gotten, it's the warbands become more unwieldy.
Sure.
Just throw a quick game together. And also the power curve after that, if you allow continuous experience gain, it will become so big that no matter what I do with the underdog bonuses or balancing, it becomes like so unwieldy for new joining in that I think it's the 12 is a good number, and I have to have something that I propose. But if people want to do a 6 the battle campaign, that's great. I am also writing a tournament campaign rule set, so you have 3 battles that you play, 2 on Saturday and 1 on Sunday, and that determines the tournament.
Very cool. All right, well, Thomas, I don't want to keep you all day, but thank you very much for talking. I'm super excited for this game, but I want to hear one more question for you, or I want to ask one more question of you. What is the thing about Trench Crusade that has you the most excited?
Oh, to me, it's the enthusiasm of the community, because there is no game without players. No company can declare a game alive or dead. There is only one force that will determine it, and that's the player base. And the seeing like how well it's been received, that's what excites me, because this is why I do this job. I mean, I want to make games that make a lot of people happy and they remember, and get inspired. Just when I was a little kid and I was inspired by D&D and the third edition Warhammer, it's that's the dream to me. It's to give something to other people that acts as inspiration and a source of strength in their life, just like games have been for me.
The Brush Builders Union is a community of like-minded miniatures gamers dedicated to playing their games fully painted and supporting one another in their craft. Brush Builders Union is here to help you stay on track with tools and a community of fellow painters to encourage you in your journey. Take the union pledge and learn more at brushbuildersunion.com.